From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition. I'm Jason Dole. Tonight, President Biden's diagnosis has put prostate cancer in the national spotlight. Patricio Rubio talks to Dr. Sheldon Axelrod, urologist, about what you need to know. That's coming up in the second half of the program. Our main topic tonight is immigration, immigration enforcement, and the local impacts of changes to immigration and homeland security policies that are coming from the Trump administration. We'll talk to Ulster County Executive Jen Metzger after Homeland Security listed her county with about 400 local governments nationwide. The Department of Homeland Security describes as sanctuary jurisdictions defying federal immigration law. Metzger is pushing back on that list and pushing back on President Trump's executive order related to this issue. We'll also get an update from Leah Mayo on last week's ICE raid on a Main Street Honesdale business, including that business's statement on what happened and the community's continued reaction. Those stories are coming right up, but first we do have an update from Albany, where a group of Democratic lawmakers are pushing to restructure the state's home care program. They say it's become more dysfunctional under changes pushed by Governor Kathy Hochul. Jung-Yoon Han from New York Public News Network has more.
The Medicaid home care program has over 200,000 consumers and about as many personal care assistants. Hochul and state health officials have ordered the program to transition to one company to oversee payments and processing for workers. But State Senator Gustavo Rivera says that transition, which was supposed to be done by April 1st, is still delayed and riddled with issues.
So first stage, workers not getting paid. Second stage, workers leaving the program. And the third stage, again, we're seeing it right now, is the participants not getting the care that they need and that they're entitled to.
The Bronx Democrat is proposing the state remove the requirement that only one company handle payments and instead create stricter licensing standards for companies hired to do the work.
We want to make sure that the good actors can maintain their operation while the bad actors go away.
Lawmakers have until mid-June, when the legislative session ends, to vote on the bill. In Albany, I'm Jung-Yoon Han for the New York Public News Network.
Thank you, Jung-Yoon. Tonight on the local edition, we are looking at immigration and immigration enforcement in our listening area, the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania, in light of shifting policies and approaches coming from the Trump administration in Washington, D.C. Ulster County Executive Jen Metzger is speaking out after the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, or DHS, publicly posted a controversial list that categorized nearly 400 cities and counties as sanctuary jurisdictions defying federal immigration law. The list drew immediate backlash from officials across the country, prompting DHS to quietly remove the page from its website. The DHS did name local governments like Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster counties. Now Ulster County Executive Jen Metzger is speaking out, calling the list arbitrary and misleading. She told Radio Catskill this week there's no clear definition of what a sanctuary jurisdiction even is, but the idea behind these designations, going back to the first Trump administration, was communities committing to protect rights guaranteed under the United States Constitution for all people, regardless of immigration status. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar spoke with Metzger on Monday.
I think a good place for us to start is if you want to just explain what a sanctuary city is, how that's defined, and what it exactly means for Ulster County residents.
I can't speak for other communities. I can tell you that, you know, we have an executive order in place in Ulster County. It was actually put in place in 2019 by my predecessor, who's now our congressman, Pat Ryan. And essentially what this executive order, and it was in, you know, reaction to policies then, threats of, you know, rounding people up. And this, we wanted, the idea behind it is that basically saying, you know, our county is not going to and does not and will not collect information on people's immigration status or share information about residents' immigration status unless required by law to do so. And further that, and again, this goes back to the processes protected established and protected under the Constitution, you know, the laws of the land in our country, that if federal immigration officials wanted to interview, detain, what have you, a person that was on county government property, they would have to show us a signed judicial warrant. And that's right. that's just process.
Yeah.
Right. So, and that's a guaranteed process. And that executive order is still in place in at least two places, references, you know, consistent with the law, consistent with federal law. So from where we stand, it is still consistent with federal law, you know.
Right.
So other communities, I think, have adopted similar policies. Now, this recent press release that was sent out by the Department of Homeland Security and that list that was published on their website, it actually is following up on an executive order issued by Trump on April 28th. Mm-hmm. This one is strengthening and unleashing America's law enforcement to pursue criminals and protect innocent citizens. And it has some very concerning provisions. Section 5, entitled Holding State and Local Officials Accountable, says the Attorney General shall pursue all necessary legal remedies and enforcement measures and shall prioritize prosecution of any applicable violation of federal criminal law with respect to state and local jurisdictions whose officials willfully and unlawfully direct the obstruction of criminal law, including by directly and unlawfully prohibiting law enforcement officers from carrying out duties necessary for public safety and law enforcement, unlawfully engage in discrimination on civil rights violations under the guise of diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives that restrict law enforcement activity or endanger citizens. So, first of all, in nowhere does this executive order actually define what a sanctuary jurisdiction is, or, you know, what they are labeling as sanctuary jurisdictions violate federal law.
Right.
It's from where I sit, the executive order in place here, our policies here are fully consistent with federal law, are fully consistent with the Constitution. And we've gotten no letters, we've gotten no follow-up. I will say that I got this same list of counties and states, I'm presuming, received a letter in December. I received a letter from the America First Foundation, so Steve Miller's like legal organization, before this administration was in office, that essentially, you know, made these same threats. And, you know, it didn't carry anything because this is some private organization issuing this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, he's part of that administration. But, you know, again, there's no clear information on what exactly these communities, any of our communities, are doing wrong, because we're not doing anything wrong, you know.
I am curious, as you said, Ulster County is in full compliance with federal law. You also hadn't received any communication from the federal government prior to this list coming out. I'm curious what your initial reactions were when you did find out that Ulster County was on this list.
I was expecting that we would be because I had gotten that letter in December.
Right.
And it's all the same people. But what was interesting is, I mean, clearly, like, no one has looked at all of these jurisdictions. It's in their policies or anything. Like, nothing's actually been reviewed. And I really don't know how that original list was put together. It was many, many counties and local jurisdictions, including a number of jurisdictions that have explicitly said that they have gone on record in the past as saying that they are not sanctuary jurisdictions. And that includes neighboring Orange County and others. And like, there's really no rhyme or reason to the counties, the jurisdictions that were included on this list. And there was an enormous outcry, especially by counties, especially by jurisdictions that, are aligned with the immigration policies of the administration, you know, and were being characterized as out of compliance or what have you. So it caused a huge uproar. And actually, if you tried to go on that page now on the Department of Homeland Security's website. It's been removed. Another part of that same executive order that I think is quite concerning is Section 4, using national security assets for law and order. And it says within 90 days of the date of this order, so maybe in a week or so, the Attorney General and Secretary of Defense, in consultation with the Secretary of Homeland Security and heads of agencies as appropriate, shall increase the provision of excess military and national security assets in local jurisdictions to assist in state and local law enforcement.
Wow.
Again, this is not consistent with the Constitution. That is, not, you know, military personnel are not supposed to be used for domestic policing. You know, we'll see what comes out on in response to this directive. But you know, there are very concerning aspects.
You know, as we discussed, the DHS, it seems to have removed this list from the website. It says page not found, but this list with cities and counties were published last week. And I'm just curious what you feel is important for residents in Ulster County to know that you want to remind folks of.
I think it's very important for residents to know that their county government is in full compliance with the law, with federal law, and that there is no basis for our county to be on a list that accuses us of otherwise. So I think that that is very important for people to know. And that we are a county that believes strongly in following the rule of law and protecting the rights that are enshrined in the United States Constitution.
We've been chatting with Ulster County Executive Jen Metzger about sanctuary cities and counties. Jen, thank you so, so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
Thank you, Kimberly. And that was a slightly edited version of Kimberly's interview with Jen Metzger. I had to cut a couple minutes out of it. The full version is up now at WJFFradio.org. Well, last week, right here on the Local Edition, I brought you the breaking news of an Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, raid on Main Street, Honesdale that resulted in three people being arrested. This took place at Elegante Restaurant and Pizzeria, the second ICE raid at the same restaurant so far this spring. Elegante released a statement Friday. For more on the restaurant's response and the response of the Honesdale community, Tim Bruno spoke with the River Reporter's Leah Mayo live on Radio Chatskill yesterday morning.
They said that both in the previous instance that you mentioned, as well as this most recent raid, all of the members who were taken by ICE to the restaurant's knowledge had legal asylum status in the United States. They said that the previously taken employee was released after immigration officials confirmed their legal status, and they remain hopeful that the same process will lead to the release of the three members who were detained in this most recent raid. But they also sort of asked for respect and understanding from the community. They said, quote, "These employees are not just staff. They are hardworking, dedicated individuals who are like family to us. We are deeply saddened by the way people can be judged based solely on appearance or where they come from rather than who they are and how they live their lives." And at least early indications are that the community has responded sort of with a lot of support for Elegantes. The day after the raid, they had sort of a very busy day and sort of released another statement saying that they appreciated all of the support they were seeing from the community.
So the community is stepping up there. I want to ask you a little bit more about community response, but also back to the statement from Sam and Tony Ann, the Elegante Restaurant and Pizzeria owners there. They also said that they are hoping that due process will bring clarity and fairness to the situation. What was your response when you first saw their statement, really?
Yeah, I mean, I was glad to hear some of the things they were, or glad to have confirmed some of the things they were saying about the individual's asylum status. That was something we had heard previously, but weren't able to confirm. The restaurant owners do say also, if it's determined that these individuals are not legally permitted to remain in the United States, we understand that the law must be upheld. However, given sort of the fact they say where the previously detained team member was determined to be in the United States legally and then released, yet sort of was taken anyways, despite that legal status. It seems likely that the same could be true of, or is likely true of, these most recent detainees, that they have legal asylum status in the U.S. and that ICE sort of has detained them regardless of that status.
You mentioned the Honesdale community responding with support of the restaurant. Has there been other response? I saw that the mayor of Honesdale posted a kind of a thoughtful post on Facebook as well.
Yeah, the mayor had a statement out about the situation, calling sort of for people to sort of listen to their local community values. He said that, you know, we should invite other levels of government to accept local values when they visit our community. Quote, perhaps some of these values are to not intimidate, to not frighten, to not traumatize, to not disrupt traffic, to not harm the downtown economy, to not obscure governmental activities, to share authorizing paperwork, to drive vehicles with government plates, and to be identifiable as representatives of the state when performing official duties. So basically saying that the way ICE agents conducted themselves and the other agencies who were present at the scene conducted themselves was against these local values. And he tied it a little bit to challenges against federal mask mandates from a couple of years ago, saying that, like, people around here don't like being told what to do, and that, and sort of making a connection between the pushback that people had to being told to wear a mask to the pushback to sort of masked, unidentified federal agents coming into a local community and doing basically as they please. He also said that a reasonable sort of way to push back against this would be just to sort of have compassion for the community. And that's been, you know, sort of a talking point throughout, is that, you know, there's not a ton you can do to challenge this in the middle of it as it's happening. But what you can do is in the aftermath, when you can reach out to your neighbors, you can support your neighbors, you can see these people as neighbors and not as sort of faceless victims of this kind of federal action.
Yeah, I mean, I read this statement on Facebook. I found it to be a thoughtful, moving statement. And have you noticed any changes in how local businesses or residents are talking about immigration enforcement since this event, and also since this plea from the mayor?
I haven't really been in touch with the community, or hearing what they've been saying since all this has happened. But the general. In general, I think there's been a lot of reflection about this and how it can happen here. I think it's one thing to see the work being done by ICE agents in the national news and to hear about it being done in communities across the country. And it is another thing entirely to see it happen to the place where you know, had your birthday party 5 years ago, or where you go to get pizza on a Friday night. So I think there's been a bit of a reckoning, and there's been a lot of reflection from the community about this, and just sort of the feeling that it has happened here.
You can read all about Liam Mayo's reporting on the ICE raid at the Elegante restaurant in the latest edition of the River Reporter, or their up-to-the-minute reporting at riverreporter.com. Liam, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Tim Bruno. Remember, you can hear Tim with live local news and conversations every weekday morning at 10 here on Radio Catskills, Radio Chatskill.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
It is The Local Edition, and I'm Jason Dole. Prostate cancer affects millions of men across the country, and with former President Joe Biden's diagnosis of an aggressive form of the disease, it's also in the national spotlight. And you may have questions about early detection, risk factors, and the latest treatment options that are available. For all of this, Radio Catskills' Patricio Rubio spoke with Dr. Sheldon L. Axelrod, a urologist with Optum Health, and clinical assistant professor at the Donald and Barbara Zucker School of Medicine at Hofstra Northwell.
So let's talk about prostate cancer. And my first question to you is, at what age should men start getting screened for prostate cancer?
Okay, great question there. Prostate cancer screening, it's been an area of controversy over the years. And multiple societies have multiple different recommendations. The one that I use is from the American Cancer Society, because they really haven't changed over the past 20 years. And I think their recommendations are good ones. So for an individual that has average risk for prostate cancer, starting at age 50 is perfectly reasonable. What do you mean by risk factors? If someone has a strong family history of prostate cancer, a direct relative, a father, brother that had prostate cancer, it makes sense to start screening at age 45. Or if someone is of African-American descent, that those folks have a higher risk of developing prostate cancer. So we start at age 45 for them as well. And if someone has multiple risk factors, strong family history of prostate cancer, multiple relatives that have had it, we start a little bit earlier at age 40.
Oh, wow. What are some of the early warning signs or symptoms of prostate cancer?
Yeah, that's another great question. As far as it goes, really none. When someone has symptoms that are related to prostate cancer, usually the prostate cancer is significantly advanced, and that would be bone pain or difficulty urinating. Most people, however, that have difficulty urinating don't have prostate cancers from benign growth of the prostate. So the only way of really picking up prostate cancer early is through the screening process.
And you mentioned about family history. So how do family history and genetics influence a man's risk for prostate cancer?
Yeah, as far as it goes, the vast majority of prostate cancers are what we call sporadic, meaning that no one in their family ever had the disease and someone develops it. So just because you don't have a family history of prostate cancer doesn't mean that you're safe. In terms of genetics for prostate cancer, unlike with breast cancer, we typically don't do a whole lot of genetic testing on people that have prostate cancer unless they have a very strong family history of it. And there are multiple genes that are felt to be responsible for prostate cancer. One of those is the same one that causes breast cancer in women, interestingly enough. But again, most cases are sporadic. Most cases, there is not a strong family history. And just because someone has a completely normal MRI, a lot of people take that, I clearly don't have prostate cancer. Not so much the case. In people with that abnormal statistical PSA density, it's been shown that about 25% of people with completely normal MRIs will have prostate cancer. And there was a recent article that showed if you were African American and you had an abnormal PSA density, even with a clean MRI, there was a 35% chance of detecting prostate cancer. So in the office, we do an ultrasound and biopsy. Many people do that with just some local anesthetic alone. But people that are more sensitive, we have an anesthesiologist that comes by the office and they can give them some sort of sedation and make them more comfortable during the procedure.
You get that news that is might be possible or do you have prostate cancer? Mm-hmm. What treatments options are available for someone who has been diagnosed with prostate cancer?
Okay. Another great question. All prostate cancers aren't the same. Based upon the PSA blood test, the appearance on the MRI, and the microscopic appearance of the prostate cancer is lumped into, early prostate cancer is lumped into three groups. Something we call low-risk disease, intermediate-risk disease, and high-risk disease. In people with low-risk disease, the treatment is basically just observation, just carefully watching them to make sure the disease doesn't progress. In people with more significant disease, then treatment is generally recommended. For people that are relatively young and healthy, I typically recommend the surgical removal of the prostate. So that's something that we've been doing robotically up here for the past 20 years. We were actually one of the first centers to do robotic prostatectomy in Westchester County. And that's a procedure that's fairly common. I did one yesterday. The patient will probably leave the hospital today. I have another one coming up on Monday. That gives you the highest probability of being cured. For the younger, healthier individuals, that's the way to go. If someone is a bit older or just doesn't want to have surgery done, then radiation therapy is a good option. If it's very early stage disease, sometimes a 5-day course of radiation therapy is sufficient. For people with more significant disease in the prostate, Typically, they get a combination of a medication, which turns off the male hormones temporarily, in addition to a 5-week course of radiation.
Right. Now, how might prostate cancer treatment affect the patient's daily life or long-term effect? You talked about having surgeries compared to radiation treatment.
Sure. Yeah, in terms of long-term effect, with surgery, again, most people do very well. They leave the hospital the next day, and probably the majority of cases. But there are some potential long-term issues. The major thing that people are always concerned about is the loss of urinary control. Fortunately, nowadays with robotic surgery, the odds of having excellent urinary control are very good, greater than 95%. And many of the folks that have enlarged prostates, believe it or not, urinate better after the surgery than they did before. The other aspect that men are always concerned about is the ability to achieve an erection. And that goes by stage of disease and how young and how good their erections were preoperatively. If someone is 49 years old with good solid erections preoperatively with early stage disease, the chances of them having good erections after the surgery is very good, probably 90% plus. But in the average person that we diagnose this on, people in their mid to late 60s that has surgery, the odds become less, probably around 60 to 70%. With radiation therapy, that's also an issue. Probably about 40% of people will lose the ability to have an erection, but it doesn't happen right away. It happens over a number of years. And people can have some urinary symptoms related to radiation therapy as well. But in general, it's pretty well tolerated.
Hearing all that, are there any sort of lifestyle changes men can make to help reduce their risk or of developing prostate cancer?
Yeah, another great question. And people always ask this. And unfortunately, the answer we give them is probably not so much. There's no real hard evidence that significant lifestyle changes make a whole lot of difference. However, having said that, anything you do that's good for your heart can't be bad for your prostate. So diet, exercise, keeping yourself in shape, not becoming very overweight, it definitely can't hurt. There's not a whole lot of evidence that it does you a lot of good. The other thing is supplements. You always see these ads on TV, radio, for these prostate supplements. Nothing has been shown to reduce the risk of prostate cancer. The supplements that we thought were going to work, there's a good study done, finished about 10 years ago, using vitamin E and something called selenium. As it turns out, it made absolutely no difference. So it doesn't pay to waste a lot of money on supplements for this particular problem.
Wow. Dr. Axelrod, thank you so much for talking to me. I learned a lot just in this conversation alone. So thank you so much for this. We were talking to Dr. Sheldon Axelrod, a urologist for Optum Health. Again, thank you so much for this. I do really appreciate it.
Okay, thank you for having us.
In Liberty, I'm Patricio Roballo for Radio Cats.
Thank you, Patricio. Well, that's almost it for this episode of the Local Edition. I do have two quick things before we go. The first is that there's a blood drive happening at the Liberty Fire Department tomorrow. It goes from noon to 6. This is the Jack Foster Family Blood Drive, hosted by the American Red Cross Blood Services. And again, that's at the Liberty Fire Department on Sprague Avenue in Liberty, New York, going from noon to 6 tomorrow. The other thing I want to let you know about is an update on the threats to public media, because we're now facing our most immediate and serious threat yet, as the Trump administration has sent Congress a rescissions package that would claw back more than $1 billion in public media funding that was already approved by law. If Congress enacts this package, it would instantly destabilize local public radio and TV stations nationwide, just like this one here, Radio Catskill. So this is not a distant threat. This threat is here. It's happening now. For more information on this issue and quick and easy ways to reach your representative, please go to protectmypublicmedia.org. That's protectmypublicmedia.org. The best way that you can help with this issue right now is going there, checking it out, loading up on info, and then spreading the word, sharing the link, telling the whole world, protectmypublicmedia.org. Well, that's it for me. I'm Jason Dole. This has been the Local Edition. I'll be back tomorrow night. We'll do it again here at the same time. For now, stay with us. We have more news on the way with The Daily. This is Radio Catskill.
Dine. I'm Jason Tuga, host of The Mixtape. I play classics you love, deep cuts, and brand new music. Friday nights at 7, only on Radio Catskill.